5th episode of First Run Radio. I'm Andy Roth.
And I'm Tony Chad.
And in the week that Henry Blofeld retires from commentary, welcome to the podcast that will try to do its bit to keep up his legacy of talking about pigeons, cranes, buses and other irrelevant things.
And true to the Blower's tradition, we're not going to be talking really about any of the cricket that's been happening in the world recently, any of the test matches. We're going to be talking instead about ticket prices. We're going to be talking about the Refugee Cricket Project. We're going to be talking about small county games in Wales, and we're going to be diving back into the past to a game between South Africa and New Zealand in the 1950s, and then courtesy of Steve Neal's book, Over and Out, Albert Trott, the man who cleared Lords. Now, here in Australia, it's kind of, we're just coming into spring and the days are getting brighter, and I'm looking forward to getting out on the cricket pitch, but obviously you're in the UK coming to the end of the summer, and you have been kind of taking an opportunity to spend some last final days watching cricket.
Yes, I mean, there's a lot of hand-wringing in the UK about the increased cost of watching live cricket, and the focus is always on the ticket prices at the big tests at Lords and the Oval, which I think at the top level can be quite eye-watering. But the last couple of weeks have reminded me that actually top-level cricket doesn't do a bad job of making itself affordable. As we all know, England and West Indies produced a wonderful test at Headingley. Day four was just £15, day five a tenner, and you know what a day five it was. I remain absolutely gutted that I didn't take the day off and go on take up that day five offer. I was considering that very seriously.
So did you go to day four?
I didn't go to either.
Oh, you didn't go to either of them.
But this is sort of things I would have done in my dreams rather than things I actually did.
If the business of Monday to Friday work didn't get involved.
Yes, well, this sort of was the problem. I think that day five, obviously, you are taking a bit of a gamble in that, had West Indies been rolled over in a morning, it would have been a long way to go to watch that. But of course they didn't, and it was a stunning display. And I think just more generally, I think you know to be watching Test cricket at a ground like Headingley for that price, and I think it's a real credit to Yorkshire that they were innovative and imaginative in terms of looking to get the price that would fill the ground up, which should surely be your aim all the time. The offer I did take up is that of free entry after tea for county championship games at the Oval. I think this is one of those things I used to know about when I lived in Brixton and then forgot about and have recently been reintroduced to by a work colleague. And it feels absurd. You rock up at the Oval and you just walk straight in, and it feels like you're doing something naughty. You feel like, God, I must have a ticket. I must go to... But no, you just stroll in. And of course, if you get into the Oval at 4 o'clock on a county championship, you've got two and a half hours of top quality cricket to watch.
So this is a kind of slip away from work early and get a couple of hours in at the end of the day, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And I do have, my colleague is an absolute pro at this, I think it's fair to say. And has, you know, he is there sort of almost more often than not in the summer. I sadly, the demands of work have got in the way of cricket too often, but it's a wonderful thing. And I mean, you are watching, you go to somewhere like Surrey, and the quality of players you've got on show, and you think to be watching this for free, it does feel ludicrous. And I think it sometimes is worth making the comparison. I mean, I only the other day paid £30 each for tickets to watch what I have no doubt will be some extremely mediocre second tier English football. And that's 90 minutes of mediocre football for £30. So I think sometimes we can perhaps be a little bit harsh on cricket, and there are certainly aspects of it that are doing a good job to make it an affordable afternoon or evening out.
I think there's definitely something there in the kind of polarisation of those prices. Because so, for instance, here in Sydney, the Big Bash League, the 2020 league, you can go to for... think kind of $15-$20, which is about £10. You can get a ticket to, you know, a Big Bash game of an evening, and it's, you know, a sold out SCG, and you know, you get good players there, and it feels very sort of price competitive. But then I've just been buying a few tickets for the Ashes, and the price is extraordinarily high. So for a day at the Ashes, you know, you're paying, I think I paid $130 for each ticket, which is £70 a ticket. And so there is this astonishing kind of polarization that exists between certain games, which are, you know, cheap and jiffy and you can get into, and other ones that are really priced at a premium and seem to be kind of targeting a completely different audience.
It's interesting because I don't know how much of an allowance you make for the fact, and I have seen this defense made of some of the expensive test prices in England, is that you are paying for a day, and whether you say, well, actually, you know, that's a different offer to paying for an hour or so. I mean, I think it's obviously basic, not that I need to give any of our listeners an economics lectures, but with the Ashes, it's sort of basic supply and demand stuff. I mean, if they can sell these venues out at $130, I suppose they would. I've always thought Australia has the massive advantage with things like the Big Bash, that there are grounds of 70, 80,000 there, or not 90. Am I making that up? Is Melbourne 90,000?
The MCG is something ludicrously large, like 90,000, I think.
Whereas, of course, in the UK, none of our cricket grounds come anything near that, which does naturally create a bit of a sort of paucity of supply. But anyway, we're probably not going to solve the problem of fair ticket pricing in this episode. And you've been focusing on a story that is, well, very uplifting, actually.
Yeah, so this is a film that I stumbled across the other day. It's called Second Innings, and it's a short documentary film. It's only about 20 minutes long. It's a short documentary film about something called the Refugee Cricket Project, which is an organisation that I'd never come across before. It's a London-based charity, and what it does is it basically, specifically actually for Afghan men, takes people who are a part of the asylum system in the UK, in London, who are going through the asylum process, and through cricket gives them a kind of support network. So it's a way for them to meet other people. It's also a way for them to meet a group of people who can talk to them about the asylum process and what they'll be going through and things like that. And what really struck me about this was just the astonishing power of cricket as much as anything, you know, to take individuals who are facing these, you know, individuals from usually pretty terrible backgrounds who are basically on their own and up against this kind of giant faceless immigration system, and frankly quite unfriendly immigration system that the UK has. And what cricket can do is actually give them an alternative structure to that, an alternative kind of way of thinking about their place in a country and even the kind of logistics of what they're going to do going forward. There was quite, the reason I came across it was Barty Roney in the Guardian wrote an article about it, and Roney makes a comparison to the incredible power of cricket in creating cohesion between particularly the West Indian and white communities in South London in the 60s and 70s. And what this organization is doing on a much, much smaller scale feels in a way, you know, significant in a similar way too. So yeah, as you say, it's a really uplifting project, and in fact one that you can I would be remiss if I didn't say, but also one that you can donate to, which I did earlier today.
I think what seems a real strength of it is playing to a passion that's there, isn't it? I mean, with the Afghanistan's love of cricket has been, you know, well documented, and the sort of speed at which the sport has sort of grown there. So if you're actually going to try and give a new community to the UK a way, as you say, of sort of integrating it, you know, why not play to a passion that's sort of already there? I think the other thing that's quite neat is there's sort of two levels to this, isn't there? There's that sort of level of, you know, the amateur and the fun of the game, but also, you know, for some of the counties, there's always the prospect of another pipeline of talent, isn't there? You know, there's that sort of more self-interested side as well.
Well, absolutely, and there are some references to this situation that I don't know a huge amount about, whereby your application process for asylum can be fast-tracked if you have specific skills that are taken on by certain counties. And so you will actually have people who are saying, oh, can you give this player a game? You know, they're a decent player, and actually it will help them with their asylum application. So it gives a completely new angle to the whole meaning of cricket, with the kind of social meaning of cricket. So back to county cricket, and it hasn't just been prices that you've been thinking about in terms of the of your interaction with the game.
So I think coming to the end of the season, you have naturally reflect on what has come before. And I've managed to watch a fair bit of county cricket this year. I think I've moaned before on the podcast that the schedule isn't that favourable to those of us who have a relatively normal job, and particularly those of us who also play the game on Sundays. And I'm also, I much prefer to watch the four-day stuff. I don't love watching the limited overs. And if that's your interest, it's actually quite hard if you to make it work within the schedule. But I've had a couple of wonderful days at Lord's, been to the Oval, and we, of course, had a lovely evening at a 2020 in Essex. But my sort of regret for the season is that Chelmsford is the only new ground I visited this year, and I sort of started with big ambitions to see more. And I think there is always this problem that the, you know, living in London, the sheer convenience of Lord's and the Oval is hard to beat. But I think I must plan better and be more ambitious next year, I think. The opportunity to go to some more far out grounds, I think, would be great.
I think you're absolutely right. It's all in the planning, isn't it? Because we talked for ages about the, you know, I obviously stymied some of these plans by moving to the other side of the world, which makes it more difficult. But, you know, talked for ages about, you know, getting to Colwyn Bay and those kinds of beautiful, legendary outgrounds. And in a way, you do need to. There was that guy, wasn't there, in the following a football team, or he went to all of the league grounds or something, you know, over the course of a single season. And in a way, you do need to set yourself a target like that, or as some people do with other things, get, you know, start fundraising for it, and then you force people to, you know, you could say, I'll give, you know, X amount to charity by going to a whole number of cricket games, and then everyone's a winner.
Yes, and I think also perhaps the other thing is you need to be open to making a day or a week. I've got actually a friend at work who is doing the 92 with English football grounds, and I think one of the things he says about it, and I'm sure it's exactly the same for cricket, is you go to these grounds in places that you wouldn't necessarily have gone to otherwise, and you think, well, actually, I'll make a bit of a day of it or even a weekend of it, and I'll explore and I'll get, you know, and I think perhaps that's the attitude to take. Rather than sort of trying to make it an efficient, quick visit in the way that you could do at a local ground. Now, one place that would be a lovely place to go and watch cricket is Pembrokeshire. And you've been keeping alert on a storm brewing there. Well, I think it's brewed, actually.
I think it has brewed, and I'm sure many people have kind of come across this. It was a story that caught my eye for a number of reasons, one of which is I actually, as a child, went on a lot of holidays to Pembrokeshire, which is on the Welsh coast, very picturesque little part of the world, and not one that you often hear about. But it has been in the headlines recently after a end of season league game kind of turned a bit strange. Basically, the situation was that the little village of Carew, I'm not even sure if that's how you pronounce it, but we'll go with it. Carew, they were 21 points ahead of Cresselly, and basically they were playing each other at the end of the season. So Cresselly got the next 22 points, then they would have won the league. Now the rules were, bear with me for a second, the rules were you get 20 points for a win, and then you get extra points for bonus points on top of that every time you either score 40 runs or take two wickets. Now, of course, Cresselly needed 22 points, so they had to win and get two bonus points. And what Carew did in order to preclude this happening and make absolutely sure that they won the league was that they won the toss, they put themselves into pass, they reached 18 for one, and then they declared. And by doing that, they made absolutely sure that Cresselly could not win the league. Because even though Cresselly would have got the 20 points for the win, they would never have been able to get a bonus point because they hadn't taken two wickets. And because they were only chasing 18, they were never going to score 40 runs. Now, this has caused a, you know, pretty substantial furore. Actually, the first I saw of it was that it was on the mainstream news here in Australia. And similarly, I've been reading that, you know, newspapers in India and all over the cricketing world have taken this up. And also it's been, I think you were saying earlier, Andy, it's been on the BBC News as kind of one of the headlines. And it's one of these moments where the spirit of cricket, the idea of the spirit of cricket is kind of wheeled out. People get very kind of head up about it. And it seems to me a little bit of a pity that, sure, we might not agree with this particularly hard-nosed sense of playing the rules. And it does in many ways, you know, hark back to things like Australia bowling, infamously bowling underarm to New Zealand so they couldn't hit a six off the last ball to win the World Cup or whatever that competition was. But it does seem to me to be a little bit of a pity when so many people have come out, you know, it looks as if Carew are going to be chucked out of the league and not allowed to play anymore. You kind of think, don't we need a little bit of sort of sense of proportion around this?
I just wonder, a lot of it comes down to how seriously you think we should all be taking club and village cricket. And this is, I think it's a really difficult question, because I think from the outside, it's very easy to be like, oh God, they're all taking it too seriously. But for the people who play in the, you know, crew first 11 or whatever, this is serious. It is there, you know, and they want to win. I mean, I'm sure you've experienced the same. And part of the reason I play in the team I now play in is that, frankly, I got a little bit tired of people taking league cricket overly serious, in my view, sort of overly seriously. Mm-hmm. But then I think I do understand that for certain people, that's what they want to get out of it. And if you don't want to get involved in that level of seriousness, there are plenty of clubs where you don't have to.
From the archives, and this episode, Andy is going to tell us about something that I've never heard about before, something that he has cryptically and enticingly entitled Burt Sutcliffe and Bob Blair's Heroic Stand.
So it's Boxing Day in 1953, South Africa versus New Zealand. This is a New Zealand test team that have still never won a test match. It's the second test of the series. South Africa have routed New Zealand by an innings in the first. The New Zealand team awake on Boxing Day to terrible news. There's been a train crash in New Zealand that has killed 151 people. That includes the fiancé of the team's star fast bowler, Bob Blair. The team heads to the match in shock, with Blair very understandably left behind. And there were questions already in the team at this point about whether they really should be playing at all. But they do go and they do get on with the game. South Africa put on 272 in the first innings. All the reports from the time suggest this was a seriously lively pitch. And when New Zealand come into bat, South Africa's seam attack of Neil Adcock and David Ironside soon unleash the short stuff in order to make the best of this. And apparently as well, lots of things just getting up off a length as well. So a real handful. Burt Sutcliffe comes out to bat with New Zealand at 9 for 2 in real trouble. And I'll let him take over with the description of what happens next. From the first over, it was clear that we were in for a warm time. I love warm time as a description of what was presumably...
the biggest understatement of all time.
Exactly. A ball flying at your head is described as a warm time. I had played only 2 balls from Adcock when another flew at my head. I tried desperately to hook but was hit on the side of the head and went out like a light. Blood was pouring from a split in his ear and he was led to hospital where he collapsed twice more. So I think it's reasonable to assume that we're dealing with a pretty serious concussion injury at this point. I mean, if you've collapsed on the pitch, you've collapsed twice in the hospital. This is not a glancing blow. This is serious.
The other thing that probably indicates something to do with that, and something to do with the sort of spirit in which this, I suppose, short bowling was played in that day and age, was the fact that he was trying to hook it. You know, he's 3 balls in, and he's trying to hook a bouncer at his head rather than trying to just to get out of the way of it. Indicates that he would have been hit pretty flush, but also the fact that he was looking to kind of take on the bowling in the way that, you know, attack was always seen as the best form of defence back in the day, whereas now you just get out of the way of it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point because I'm quite regularly lectured by some of the older players at my club on the fact that, you know, in the good old days when we didn't wear helmets, we were brilliant at just watching the ball and getting out of the way of it. And I'm sure there is some truth in that, actually, that modern players are maybe a bit more willing to absorb a blow to the helmet. But in fact, in this case, as you say, that this shows a kind of a willingness to absorb a blow to the head, I guess. Not surprisingly, the doctor's orders from the hospital are rest. By lunch, New Zealand are 57 for 5, with Laurie Miller, another New Zealand batsman, having joined Sutcliffe at the hospital after a blow to the chest. I mean, this is in every way a horrible, horrible day for New Zealand. Now, Sutcliffe is back at the ground. He's decided that he will do his resting there because I think, like all of us, doesn't like spending more time than he has to in a hospital. But with New Zealand at 81 for 6, he ignores the doctor's wishes and comes into bat. Now, thinking about the situation, I know in the modern game there are plenty of examples where players have gone into bat with injuries, but I think this is something that you would not see today because there is now a real awareness within sport of the dangers of concussion injuries and blows to the head in particular. I think you'll see batsmen come out to bat with broken fingers, you know, even I think in certain cases sort of broken arms, but I really don't think you would be allowed today to get anywhere near the pitch having collapsed 3 times.
The other thing that's curious is that throughout this entire game, because presumably the South Africans knew that you know, the news that the New Zealand squad had got at the beginning of the day about what had happened back in back home in New Zealand, they then, would have known that the pitch was a spicy one. And the fact that they hospitalized two people, indicates they just carried on bowling short stuff at them. And so when Sutcliffe goes back out, presumably he's not thinking, oh, they'll go easy on me. There's absolutely no indication that South Africans aren't just going to carry on bowling bouncers at him.
Yeah, and I think it's very difficult because presumably it is both the short stuff, but it's also just a lively pitch. And I mean, I'm sure we've all experienced it where actually sometimes I admit, I don't bowl at a pace that makes this happen very often, but you may be bowling in an actually a quite sort of ordinary way. And if the pitch is a
True,
minefield, it's a
just nips up.
minefield. Exactly. I'm really curious in this incident what other situations would have got Sutcliffe to come out to bat. I think, say New Zealand were only 50 behind, and with the chance of a lead, would he have come out to try and give them, a chance of winning a test match? Would he have come out to bat if they were loads of runs ahead? Just, but what's clear is that the motivation here was pride. New Zealand were being humiliated. They were still a long way away from even avoiding the follow-on here. And at 81 for six, he has come out because it's a national pride thing. He admitted afterwards that he was fortified to some extent by a generous helping of Scotland's chief product. And I think there is something kind of wonderful in the idea that you would steel yourself with a couple of whiskies before going out to face the attack. Although I think, again, would probably fall a long way short of doctor's orders. He instantly went on the attack, striking his third ball for six, and his partnership with Mooney at the other end improbably saw New Zealand pass the follow-on target. And I think, as you said, it was interesting that he was struck while hooking the ball. And his clear decision here seems to be, with the pitch being erratic, New Zealand still needing a lot of runs to avoid the follow-on, fight fire with fire, go on the attack. And I think always important to remember that, we get sort of changed by comparisons of what we see in Test cricket now, but this would have been a bold way to go out and bat. Now, the ninth wicket falls, and we remember that New Zealand are a player down because Bob Blair has been left at the hotel, and Sutcliffe and the fielders begin to walk off. They then see Blair on the boundary, and he comes up to Sutcliffe and says, "I'd like to feel I can help." And he's padded up, ready to go, and they return to the middle, arm in arm. And I think if we think of Sutcliffe's heroism here in terms of batting with what was clearly a serious injury, a blow to the head, there is a different sort of heroism here from Blair. He has found out only the morning before that his fiancée has died in this tragic accident. He's been left grieving. But his decision that what he wants to do most at that time is to come and be with his teammates and help with his teammates is clearly an act of extreme bravery, and reports from the time suggest he got a huge response, not surprisingly, from the South African crowd. Now, with one wicket to go, the attack went up a notch. Hugh Tayfield, who actually is kind of probably one of the only names in this South Africa team who you might well remember, because he was really noted as a very miserly and effective spin bowler, was struck for 25 off and over, Sutcliffe hitting three sixes, Blair hitting one. And again, important to remember that this is in a sort of pre-Ben Stokes era where people didn't do this very often.
And you do get that real sense that, there's this kind of, in a way, perfect storm of the fact that the team has been completely routed in the first test and are completely up against it again. So there's that context to it. There's the context of being, hospitalised by a bowler and wanting to get your pride back. And then also that I think it's a really telling that line, "I feel like I'd like to feel I can help." That sense of real helplessness you feel when, someone you love has died, but when you're also, thousands of miles away, and back then, however long it took on a ship to get back to New Zealand, so suddenly you get with Blair this real sense of just wanting to sort of contribute something, to do something meaningful. So what happened? Did this have? Tell me, this had the perfect ending, and they put on a stand of 300 and beat the Saffers?
It sadly did not. There is not a fairy tale ending to the game. In that there's not actually much of note really to say about the rest of the game. South Africa went on to complete what was in the end a relatively routine 132 run victory. New Zealand cricket writer Dick Brittenden has a lovely line about this where he says it's a story every New Zealand boy should learn at his mother's ear. And it is certainly a story where we often talk about, this bizarre thing with cricket and sport in general where it doesn't matter at all, and yet sometimes it can matter so much. And you have here one player who is acting with sort of showing a bravery that would be brave in any context, you know, that physical bravery, battling with an injury, and another one who is with having gone through what an extreme trauma, has found some sort of solace in cricket, has found a solace in his teammates, has found a solace in putting up a fight, putting up a stand. There's actually a further kind of quite sad postscript to this story, in that Sutcliffe said that he was never really the same batsman after this game. He talks about having lost his nerve after being hit by Adcock, working hard to overcome it, but the problem remained. And I think this is something that we now maybe understand a little better in cricket. You know, there's been a lot of talk, for example, of the fact that Stuart Broad was never really able to play pace bowling the same way after being struck in that game against India. But I think a sad reminder here that sometimes these moments can actually have a long-term impact on the career, regardless of the heroism shown. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading Over and Out, Albert Trott, The Man Who Cleared the Lord's Pavilion by Steve Neal. Now, I learnt a huge amount of rather unexpected things while reading this book. What, Toby, was the most surprising thing you learnt?
Well, actually, probably the most surprising thing that I learnt was the fact that you can get a cold in the eyes and that there's such a cricket shot as a carpet drive. Which were both facts that came up during this book, and I'd actually be interested. I've been trying to Google what a carpet drive is. At some point, a player is referenced as unfurling a carpet drive, and I can't find out what that is. So, if Steve or indeed anyone else listening knows, then if they could let us know, that would be fantastic. But actually, the thing I think that I learned that was interesting here was that behind the two things that we know about Albert Trott in popular legend, one of which is, as the title of the book suggests, the fact that he hit a ball over the pavilion at Lord's. The other one, rather more tragically, being that he actually ended up committing suicide by shooting himself, is actually that, in a way, those are two of the least interesting things about him. And actually, the story of his life and the way that his life unfolds between Australia and England is actually in and of itself the most fascinating thing about the man.
Yeah, we have this, is so often when you read historical cricket books, the parallels with the present become very obvious, and not surprisingly, the lesson you so often learn is that the things you think are totally new aren't. And I guess one of the big things with Albert Trott is the whole eligibility question. So he finds himself, to paraphrase quite quickly, in a bizarre position where he is too English to be picked for Australia and too Australian to be picked for England. And this feels like an extremely modern sort of debate. You think of the angst England have had in recent years over the appropriateness or not of picking South African players of South African origin for England. And I think what this book really shows is that whatever we think of the current situation, at least there are clear rules. What Albert Trott really suffered from is just a sense of people would make their mind up. They would just decide whether he was too English or too Australian. And I think there was particularly a very tragic thing with Archie McLaren, who, when he became captain of the England team and was clearly a big fan of Trott, he said, if we could not beat Australia with Englishmen, we could not beat them with Englishmen and Australians.
Yeah, exactly. It's all decided by this kind of slightly vague moral stance on you know, what we would like to think of our kind of national makeup of our team, rather than actually any, as you say, any kind of clear rules that are set out behind it.
And I think the other side that's extremely modern, and again, funnily enough, it almost takes us back to someone like Kevin Peterson, is that we talk now about, you know, the Chris Gayles of this world going round to all these 2020 leagues, you know, gun for hire. And we think Trott was that sort of player. His life was incredibly international, coaching in New Zealand, playing in South Africa, playing in England, playing in Australia, and playing in India. You know, you had someone who, at this early stage, when travel was obviously so much more of a hassle, was building a very international and mercenary
career. Exactly, and the flip side of that, and quite how extraordinary that career was, is actually thrown into quite sharp relief by his brother Harry, who ends up captaining Australia for many years and becomes a kind of a bastion of the Australian cricketing establishment. Very sadly, actually gets dementia, or what is thought of as being dementia towards the end of his life.
And I think it's this willingness to go exploring that I think is very exciting. And this is going exploring at a time when all of these things would have been a bigger culture shock, a big effort. I mean, stories of at one point in Zimbabwe and South Africa, I think a 55-hour train journey to play a game, you know, giving an idea of the sort of exploits that they were undertaking. I think also this idea of the precariousness of it all. I mean, he was a very successful player, maybe not able to fully fulfill his potential. But even he found himself very quickly in dire financial straits by the end of his career. And you see that a lot of it was just bad luck. You know, he had a benefit game that, due to poor weather, didn't make what it should. And for someone who had been at the top of the game, played in all these places, he very soon found himself having to umpire to kind of make ends meet, and having to umpire despite having an illness that meant really standing up all day was the very, very worst thing that could have happened to him.
You do get the sense of of him being a kind of maverick too. There is a very good point, I think, that Steve Neal makes around the fact that he created this kind of improvised shot that involved hitting the ball basically somehow behind the keeper's head and ends up, you know, hitting it so hard into the groin of the wicketkeeper that he thinks he's killed him. We've all thought we've been killed by being hit by a cricket ball in the groin. But this real sense of someone who does play kind of outside the rules and again outside the establishment comes across quite strongly. I think the one thing that is remarkable about this book actually is that it is clearly a passion project. I think that Steve Neal was behind the campaign to get the blue plaque on Trott's house in wherever it is in the UK, and clearly has been fascinated by the life of this man for many, many years. And in the past, we've sometimes found that people who have passion projects books can often get a bit carried away by that, to the extent that people who aren't quite so much involved in that passion can't necessarily share it or get a bit lost by it. But I found actually that this book was immensely readable, and part of that was because not only is it about Trott, it's also about the culture of the time and the sport of the time and a whole wider range of issues. You know, one of them, very small example, being the prevalence of baseball and skittles in Melbourne at the end of the 19th century as actually competitors to cricket. Cricket wasn't the, you know, necessarily the clear sport you go down if you were sportingly talented. Baseball and skittles were the other things.
Yeah, well, we were all aware of sort of cricket and baseball in the US kind of having an early sort of conflict, but the idea that baseball was a serious presence in Australia was certainly new to me. I also loved, as an interesting historical aside, this game in February 1908 of a cricket match at the Coliseum in St Martin's Lane. So cricket in a theatre, a four-a-side cricket game with the crowd as fielders. I mean, completely mad, and ultimately not an experiment that's to work, but another wonderful example of sort of cricket innovation. I think, you know, you mentioned that the two things we really know he is known widely for is the hit over Lords and the tragic suicide. And it's very interesting how the hit over Lords becomes something of a burden. There was a lot of talk about the fact that actually he played with a bat that weighed over 3 pounds, and it was described as a savage beast of a thing by contemporaries. And there was the idea that actually he became so obsessed with hitting the ball hard that it actually overshadowed his other skills and actually weakened his ability to bat by the end of his career.
There is a very evocative passage at the very beginning of the novel when Neil is describing that moment when he hits the ball over Lords, and I found it actually quite eerie in the sense that you can really sympathise with that as a bad amateur cricket. You know those days when you do go out and you do just want to hit the ball as far as you possibly can, and that's usually the days when you have no form whatsoever and get out very easily. But that real sense of tunnel vision towards just wanting to hit the ball as far as possible was something that actually came across quite strongly.
So that was Over and Out by Steve Neal. The Life of Albert Trott comes with our hearty recommendations. And that was the 95th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. Thank you for joining us, and please join us soon.